Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Today,
here's John Williams.
I actually have one. Watch this. Mm-hmm. It's 108. This is John. We're in the sunny Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, looking out at a lovely May day. How about them apples? All the way until White Sox baseball here on WGN. They should have played it at the Cell. That'll start at 2. So what will we do? We'll make the most of the remaining 51 minutes that we can. I think they'll be good. I was thinking about Bill and Wendy today, and they both popped into my studio just like 90 seconds ago, looked at me, and then Bill said, I don't think that's such a bad haircut. And then he popped out.
We came in to specifically look at your haircut because I saw you in the hallway either yesterday or the day before, and I was thinking, boy, that JW has some fantastic hair.
Thank you for thinking that.
When I heard you got it cut, I had to go look.
And then a couple minutes later, Jazz, your producer, pops in, just looks at me kind of sideways and goes, eh. So I'm sorry that my hair has been such a topic of conversation. I went upstairs to Bertha, who resides on the 9th floor here and cuts hair, and she's fantastic. Love Bertha. Love the convenience. Love the price.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Bertha. So I'm all about Bertha. But this is the other thing about Bertha, and your hairdresser may be this way, too. You always get the haircut Bertha wants you to have. I'll go, Bertha, I just need a trim, or I just need it here. She goes, okay. And then she just does what Bertha wants.
She wants you to get your money's worth.
I could tell her I want an afro-colored blue, and I would get this cut because... That's the cut Bertha wants me to have.
It's the Bertha.
It is the Bertha.
It looks very good.
I just posted on my Facebook page the following. I'm reading When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing by Daniel Peek. It's fascinating stuff. Peek describes the happiness and alertness levels we feel at different times of the day. We are more alert and content, clear thinkers. From 10 a.m. until noon, think WGN's Bill and Wendy. The arrow, however, starts to plummet on our cognitive and happiness abilities during my show from 1 to 3. Dang.
That's accurate.
He offers this quiz to make a point. Violetta, did you take the quiz?
I did.
Ernesto is a dealer in antique coins. One day, someone brings him a beautiful bronze coin. The coin has an emperor's head on one side and the date 544 BC stamped on the other. Ernesto examines the coin, but instead of buying it, he calls the police. Why? They say you have a much better chance of solving that riddle if you're listening to Bill and Wendy than if you're listening to John Williams because of the time of day. We're clearer, alert thinkers.
Was it a stolen coin?
I think there's information missing from the riddle.
It's all there, kids.
No, because listen.
I stopped listening after about the third word.
I couldn't even read the guy's name originally when I read it. It's Ernesto. Okay, whatever.
544 BC.
So I Googled the answer, so I know the answer.
But oh, my gosh.
I'm a millennial. What do you want me to do?
Oh, Lord. All right, well, just stop talking for 1 second.
There's something missing.
She can't.
Ernesto is a dealer in it. This is 5 sentences. Ernesto is a dealer in antique coins. One day, someone brings him a beautiful bronze coin. The coin has an emperor's head on one side and the date 540 BC stamped on the other. Ernesto examines the coin, but instead of buying it, he calls the cops. Why? Oh, you're not looking it up, are you?
Well, here's the problem. They don't tell you when this occurred. If they told you when it occurred, when did Ernesto go into the store? If it happened today, I don't think the riddle is solvable.
One more time.
Ernesto is an antique dealer in coins. Somebody brings him a beautiful bronze coin. On one side is an emperor's head. On the other side is the date, 544 BC. He looks at the coin, but then calls the cops. Why?
There were no emperors in 544 BC.
Wrong. Mm. But I like what you're doing. Now, they say that you would have a much better chance of solving this in the morning when you're more alert. I mean, think about it. You've just cashed in 3 hours of broadcasting. It's post-lunch. So it's just more difficult for people to be their mental best.
I agree.
Sometimes people just don't know riddles in general.
I think this one's kind of solvable.
You do? Because I've tried everything.
Okay, just if I may. And listen, I'm not having any fun at your expense. That's not why I asked you in here.
Oh, well, please do.
But Joe has it. Joe, you're on WGN.
Good afternoon. Somehow I came up with this in the afternoon. BC stands for Before Christ. And, of course, before Christ was born, they didn't say BC.
Because they didn't know Christ was going to be born. If it's 544 right. BC, how do you know it's B what? You don't know Christ is coming.
But
you're 500 years before the birth of Christ.
No, but that's why information is missing. What if the coin was made after Christ was born?
I think BC stands for bronze coin, if you want to know the truth.
Oh, boy.
Bitcoin.
Take care.
Oh, that was the first Bitcoin. They were ahead of their time. Good one, Kim.
You win no prizes, Joe, but if it's any consolation, you're smarter than these two.
Hold on, but so are there no coins made after BC?
I have to stop that.
I don't like it.
Okay, so if you go into a coin dealer today, if the coin was made today, it would say 2018, maybe AD.
No.
But then you would know that, I know you wouldn't, but I mean, at least then you would know Christ was born and died, and it's 10th. But you would never have the use for BC because you would never know before Christ was born. If Christ was going to be born.
True.
So the best you could do, the oldest coin you could get would be like one, right? That would be 1 year after Christ was born, or two AD, three AD, four AD. Coins that were made before then, what's the reference point? What year? BC? No, all of our years are BC and AD, but they didn't have that BC.
Too much thinking on this one.
2,000 years ago, they didn't have the birth of Christ to look back upon, so the date, I don't know what they were using BC, but it wouldn't have been a number relative to anything we're used to here, because all of our years are predicated on the birth of Christ. Now, I am making this too difficult, but anyway, that's the answer to the question. It would not have had BC on it.
Thanks for thinking big thoughts.
Now, why did the guy even
so I don't have to. I'm done. I'm spent.
Well, if it's any so, and I was thinking about you, Wendy, because I thought, well, you and Bill, I think fortunately, have people listening between say 10 and noon, and they say that is, you know, that side of noon,
the peak hours.
Yeah, that's when people are they're happier and they're you know their energy levels are better and blah blah blah. And then they hit noon and they hit that kind of wall.
That's Bertrand.
And
the Wintrust business lunch.
They say this is a national thing, but it may be Bertrand. It may actually be Steve's show that actually muddies people's thinking and happiness. And then I'm there just left to pick up the scraps. And then they say it starts to pick back up so that when Justin is on in the evening, the happiness levels are as high as they are at any point during the day. How about them apples?
Because you're off work then, typically.
I think so. I think that has a lot to do with it. It tends to peak after 5. After 5, you get off work. Boom, it goes up.
Yep.
Maybe you're doing something in the evening that's even a little more fun. You know what I mean? And by that, I mean watching television.
trying to solve riddles about BC.
Whatever makes you happy. And then it comes back down. So that's the cycle. And it's all detailed in this swell new book called When... The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. And just one other takeaway from this. So if your kids are taking standardized tests.
Yes.
You want them to take it in the morning.
Yeah.
Not the afternoon.
Yeah, because the ADHD meds are still working then.
Well, there's that
they
too.
They wear off in the afternoon.
They literally studied thousands and thousands of students around the globe. And if you factor out all of the other things and find the same kinds of kids, you will find that the kids get better scores in the morning and worse scores in the afternoon. In fact, if they take it at 8 a.m., they get the best scores. 9 a.m., a little worse. 10 a.m., a little
really?
Worse. All the way through the day. So if your kids got the test after lunch,
they're in trouble.
It doesn't help. Just a thought.
That's interesting.
All right. Thank you. You may go now.
Nice hair.
Thank you, Wendy. I appreciate you coming in and saying that. It's 1:17. It doesn't say anything about the honesty factor afternoon, but we know energy levels aren't what they are at other times of the day. Yesterday, we talked about the fact that this one guy from Illinois, he's a child family services worker, is really the focal point for this lawsuit. Against AFSCME, and the United States Supreme Court is considering it. We spoke to the co-counsel representing that man yesterday, and they said that you should not have to join a state union as a prerequisite to your working. If you want to work for the state of Illinois, you should not have to be a union member in that field, but he doesn't have that option. hence the suit. And the Supreme Court is probably going to go 5-4 on this one. We're all waiting for their results. We heard one side of the story yesterday, and that was from his attorney, who said, I shouldn't have to join the union if I don't want to. If unions are all that great, people will sign up for them, and they will, you know, be the beneficiaries of that. But what if unions aren't all that great? What if unions are misspending the money? What if you don't agree with the policies? Well, then maybe you shouldn't have to give $45 a paycheck to the union. This guy has no chance. So the other side of that BC coin, that is what we heard from his side. What's the union side? On the phone line is Roberta Lynch. She is the executive director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. That's AFSCME Council 31 here in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Roberta, you're on WGN. How are you?
Hi, John. Glad to be with you.
We talked yesterday with the co-counsel on the other side of this lawsuit against AFSCME that the Supreme Court is considering. And we thought, well, let's hear your view on it. What we heard yesterday was that the unions are making it a prerequisite for work that you have to, or the state is, making it a prerequisite to work, you have to be in the union. You have to pay union dues. And this one gentleman says, I don't want to. What do you say to him or about that?
Well, first let me say that millions of people in this country have jobs where there's no prerequisite to be part of the union. We're talking about work sites where workers themselves have voted to have union representation. And like any vote, it's a majority vote, and the union then represents the employees in that work site. And, you know, Mark Janis and anyone who he said he objects to the political decisions that the union makes, that's why the Supreme Court in 1977 ruled in a very important case, the Abood case, unanimously that if you don't want to join the union, you don't have to join the union, but you have to contribute your fair share toward the cost of that representation. And that's what's at issue in this case. And that decision in 1977 was a unanimous ruling by the United States Supreme Court,
right,
that you do not have to join the union, but you have to contribute to the cost of representation in a work site where the employees have chose to have union representation.
And he says, you know what, so in other words, I have to pay for your free speech. I mean, you all are on board, I'm not, but I have to pay in order to work there, dues that will support your view on that, and he feels that's unconstitutional.
Well, you know, we strongly disagree with that. And as I said, nine justices on the United States Supreme Court in 1977 also strongly disagreed, and there have been any number of decisions since then rejecting that point of view. There are many, many situations in which people pay fees or dues for things that they don't necessarily completely agree with. And by the way, I mean, I think that Mr. Janis is somewhat misleading people because, as I indicated, he's not contributing toward political or lobbying costs. I think his attorney had cited things like candidate endorsements. He's not contributing toward those. And what this case is really about, and this is what I think is so important, Mark Janis is one person, but this case is really about wealthy interest billionaires who don't want working people to have a voice in our society. And we already have a playing field that's very tilted against ordinary people. Rich people, corporations, big businesses, they dominate so much of politics today, and so many decisions are made to benefit them. They get the big tax breaks. They get the things that they want. And what we're trying to do is for the people that we represent to have a voice in that process.
Right.
And I would note, you know, that most of the things, many of the things that we do advocate for, lift up everybody. When in union states that have strong unions, everyone's wages are higher because unions raise the standards for everybody. Everybody benefits. In those states, people are more likely to have health insurance.
Well, so,
they're more likely to have safer jobs.
And Roberta, so we talked to his attorney about that yesterday, and he said, well, if unions are so good, and he wasn't mocking when he said this, but it was a bit of a challenge. He said, then why not leave it up to the individuals? There's this two-tier system. You do or don't have to join, but if you don't join, you still have to pay your fair share. And it's not that great a discount. But he said, look, if if the unions are so great, just put it to a test. Let the people join that want, and those who don't, don't. And if it's so strong, it'll survive. That's the marketplace. That's the way it should be.
I mean, it's important to keep in mind, really, John, that with this case, you know, Mark Janus is here and he's saying, I'm one person and I have this objection. The Liberty Justice Center that the attorney works for, who spoke to you, they are part of Illinois Policy Institute, which is part of a nationwide network, the state policy network, and they're very clear. They say their goal is to strike a mortal blow against unions, to defund, and defang the labor movement. And those, of course, are that network is funded by a wealthy network of very rich people, and they're very clear that they want to destroy unions. So this is one guy with one, I think, very unbalanced complaint, and I can come back to that. But I think the most important point to realize is, why is this lawsuit happening? It's happening because this network of wealthy people want to destroy unions, and they're very clear. They don't want working people to have a voice in the public arena.
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court has heard both sides. I have to go now, but I'm going to call on you again soon, Roberta, and we'll spend more time talking about this.
Okay, because I'd like to do that. That'd be great.
We heard one side. We heard a little bit of another side today. We'll resume this conversation soon. Thanks for joining us, and good luck to you all.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, likewise. I appreciate your time. She's the executive director of AFSCME, Roberta Lynch, here in Illinois. It's 128. That is Council 31. This is John Williams, 25 minutes away from Cubs Sox baseball. I got that wrong, didn't I? From Sox Cubs baseball here on WGN Radio. Yeah, we'll do another one of those games today. It's the first time the Cubs and Sox get a chance to play each other on the radio this year. Of course, we'll do the regular season games too, but some of these special games in the preseason we're doing as well. And so here we go. It's Sox and Cubs just after 2 o'clock. Let's advertise right at 2 o'clock in 25 minutes here on WGN Radio, and then we'll do our full show from 1 to 3 tomorrow. So I don't know if you know about this. It's kind of new, but I think this is interesting. I'll just read from a press release. Front page issues from gun rights to immigration reform are among those to be addressed by former governors Jennifer Granholm, the Democrat from Michigan, and Mike Huckabee, of course, the Republican from Arkansas, in the inaugural Critical Conversations event. It's presented by Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership. This one is going to be the inaugural one Sunday, March 18th. You can buy tickets to this event in Chicago. They're $36. Tickets are at Spertus, spertus.edu/conversations. You can actually spend $100 for VIP tickets, including a reception with the speakers. But here you have a front page Democrat and a front page Republican, and they're going to talk about everything from immigration to gun rights. So you need somebody to moderate that, right? Maybe you don't, but maybe you do. Frank Sesno is going to do so, the moderator of the Spertus Critical Conversations series launch. The renowned journalist, formerly White House correspondent and anchor for CNN, and he joins us on WGN. Hi, Frank. It's John. You're on the air. How are you?
Great, John. Thank you so much for having me.
So this is the first one. Have they done these elsewhere? It sounds like this is the first time it's happened in Chicago.
To start, this is the inaugural, and I'm very, very much looking forward to it.
So will it always be the two of them, or will there be other speakers from different perspectives?
No, I think I'm sure they're going to be looking for other people to rotate in. This is the beginning, though, and the idea is to get two prominent people, as you say, who come from opposing places, and to try to engage them in constructive conversation, dynamic dialogue, and probably some debate, probably not a little debate along the way, but, you know, really with the idea of, can we reach beyond the sort of sound-bitten world that we're in all the time and do better than this? You know, we are a country that can do better than this. So how do we start when we're coming in a time of such polarization and division?
Who's going to pick the topics and questions?
Well, we've talked about it broadly amongst ourselves, and we've communicated with both of them, and we want some of these really big, tough, grinding issues that we've got now, but we want to make sure that what we don't do, which happens too much in some public and media town halls and debates, is to have such a you know, such a laundry list of issues that you can spend, you know, 3.7 seconds on each. We'd like to have a little bit more deliberate and deliberative conversation. So we'll talk about the issue of school safety and guns. That is very prominent. We will certainly talk about immigration because that is who we are and it's defining where we're going. And there are a couple of issues that really, you know, engage the world, whether it's climate change and some foreign policy issues. But again, not a laundry list of things, but some where we really want to sink our teeth. First among them, school safety, guns, and immigration.
Maybe school safety would not have been on there a week ago. In fact, the day before the event, you may want to call an audible, right?
Well, interestingly, we did talk about this, and we were very... we felt very strongly that this is an issue because this is what we really want to do is we want to take a look at what are some very polarizing issues, but issues that we need to move past polarization and toward solution if anything's going to change. And, you know, immigration, for example, has been an issue that's been confronting this country for years. I was covering the White House, you know, when we had the last immigration bill in the 1980s, of all things. Yes, I was 4 years old, but I was a terrific 4-year-old.
Yeah.
But it's been a very long time since we did that. President George W. Bush tried, came close, and failed. And meanwhile, the problem gets worse and worse, and people are frightened on all sides, and they're looking for solutions on all sides. So what can we do about that? And guns, of course, has been a serious problem for a long time. The pain only gets worse. Florida only made the tragedy deeper. What does that change? And what will it take? And what can happen for us to address this like adults?
Yeah, maybe you've got some advice for me, because to be honest with you, I think the idea of arming teachers is so cockamamie. I don't know if I could host a two-sided conversation about that.
It's really complicated. We see some of the governors, you know, bringing to the White House, right, directly to the president, a very strong and articulate sense that teachers do not want to be carrying, many teachers anyway, or expressing to them that they are not law enforcement officers. They should not be carrying weapons. Parents do not want to be sending their children places where there are guns. But there are other teachers who say, now, hang on a second. You know, my gun can be like a fire extinguisher. And my son, who taught in Philadelphia schools, tough schools, is torn on it himself because he has seen things up close and personal. So I think it's a complicated issue, and it's one that bears, again, adult conversation to really understand it, where we can step back and say what should be happening. Clearly, there should be, you know, security and resource officers who do what they need to do, who are trained in how to use guns, but there are also teachers who are already trained. Is that viable? That's the question that we should ask, and that's the question that we need to explore, setting some of our biases and ideologies to the side if we really want a great answer on it.
Well, just engage me for a second here. 20% of the teachers? And what does trained mean? I mean, so they know how to operate a firearm?
Exactly.
Are you telling me that a weekend class or a series of classes will take a grade school teacher and make them a viable option in tactics, in taking down an intruder? I will die never believing that. It's just too crazy, a scenario. I wonder what universe the president is living in that he has in mind all of these ex-military men and women who are going to be teaching the kids. And as soon as something goes pop, pop, they take the sicko, as the president calls them, out. I just don't think that's a logical idea.
It's very problematic on a lot of different levels. I mean, you're also going to need new levels of background checks if you're going to have teachers carrying weapons in schools, right? I mean, God knows bad things happen, but if bad things happen and someone's got a gun, it can be a worse thing. And you enter all sorts of new worlds of unintended consequences, right, that we can't even think about. You know, the clear answer is you keep guns out of schools, right? It's like, you know, should pilots be armed in planes? You know, you have similar kinds of conversations about these sorts of things. So we have to be very careful. You end up with an arms race, right? And then you just have more and more weapons. On the other hand, think about how defenseless everybody was in that school in Florida, you know. And so, yeah.
Right. So maybe. Right. So
I can tell you this, as a, you know, the question also should be put to parents. Do you want to send your children to school if the teachers are armed?
Well, that's the Republican response, because the answer to that should be, well, let's leave that to the local level. If a local school district decides, yeah, we do want that. I mean, I don't know exactly how you calculate that vote. Maybe you put it up to the parents. Maybe you put it up to the faculty, probably the school board. But I mean, if at a local level they decide, yeah, we want here in Arkansas to arm our teachers because we're more comfortable with that than we are in, say, Chicago, then maybe they should have the right to do so. And then I'll just have to change states or go to a private school or something, you know?
Well, that's, you know, this, and this is what's going to be so interesting to hear these two governors about, right?
Yeah, right.
Because they come
right
from such different backgrounds, such different perspectives, and such different states. They have different, very different populations, both states diverse in different ways. And so, you know, all right, you're the governor. You're responsible for the safety of your children and your teachers. What do you do, and how do you navigate the unintended consequences? And how do you create the consensus that's going to be necessary so the place just doesn't go, you know, just flip out because you either are or not bringing guns into school? And are we really making our children safer? That's the fundamental question. What do we do to make our children safer? And how do they, as public officials, if we're going to have this conversation, this really difficult conversation, how do they, as public officials, do that when we are so confused and divided?
By the way, all of this ignores the fact that if we decide that guns in schools are a better way to protect people in schools, what about hospitals? What about movie theaters? What about concerts, right? I mean,
you are totally correct. You know, I've had the opportunity to do some work with Homeland Security and look at some of these things. And these are called soft targets. And the sad fact is that you harden one target, then you go, that someone who's intent on, you know, sowing this horrific destruction can easily go to the next. And everybody in their normal day knows what it's like because they visited 10 soft targets, whether you're going to the grocery store or the library or anywhere else. So what does that mean? You know, and I remember being in some places where terrorism is a problem, and there is somebody checking bags and an armed guard at virtually every front door of virtually every place. Is that what we're heading toward? Is that what we want? Is that what we need?
Frank Sesno's on a phone line. You remember that name, don't you? And probably Face too. Former White House correspondent and CNN anchor for how long? How long were you a White House correspondent for CNN?
Oh, gosh. I was a White House correspondent for 7-plus years at CNN. I was with CNN altogether for 21, so it was a really amazing time.
Would you want to be a White House correspondent today? Would you want to be there every day when Mike Huckabee's daughter is doing the press briefings?
Well, I would. There's a curiosity, of course, that says, yes, of course, you'd like to be there. But I think that actually, and answering you seriously, no, I'm not sure that I would be. I think that what has happened in the coverage of the White House and a lot of places, actually, is they have been so infected by the demands of digital media and constant expectation and social media of cranking it out, that we have to ask whether we are serving our audience as well with that, and whether and how we can get some more deliberative coverage, to where it's necessary. You know, these issues, like we were just talking about, are more polarizing, more divided, and more complex than they've ever been, and yet the pressure on coverage is more rapid than it's been. So I'm not sure I would want to be doing that in that way today. If I were covering the White House, I would only cover it, you know, if I could afford not to have a paycheck. If I could say, you know, sorry, I'm not going to do every little increment every 3 seconds. We need to figure out a way to bring people context, not just sound bites.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge for people like me. I mean, and I'm not even a journalist. I'm a talk show host. I can see journalism from here, but I don't adhere to or have to the same sort of principles. Opinion tends to govern what I do. And I think the problem with CNNs of the world, and let's just mention CNN here for a second, is that they lean too much like I do and not enough like they should. If the president gives a speech and we can almost factually determine that it was filled with errors or was unlike any other speech a president has given before, I don't think it serves CNN to run an article that says top 10 crazy things Trump said during his address. But they do that, and then you click through each one of them. It's digital gold, and it might even be true, but I think it belies a bias that doesn't do them or anybody any good.
I think we live in a world of clickbait now where everything is measured, and the number of clicks and eyeballs and the time spent viewing and circulation, or what has replaced circulation, which is sort of the digital count in the old newspaper world. Everybody is subject to this now, and these are the metrics by which your advertising dollars and your attention are determined. And that I think that when, you know, one of the most disturbing things I've heard is the President of the United States saying the media are the enemy. When there are real enemies out there and the media, whether we like them or not, and by the way, Thomas Jefferson did not like them very much, but still said, given a choice between a republic and a newspaper, I'll take the newspaper. You know, knowing that people need to be informed. But when you play that role, just like you said, when you play that role, you kind of become the enemy. Right. You know, when you are name calling, when you are throwing labels like that. So I'd like to see some more restraint all around. But, you know, is that going to happen in the world we're in now and how money is made? I'm not terribly optimistic about that.
All right. Well, I'm going to when I get to be king, and Frank, the paperwork is tied up in an office here in Cook County. But when
I think we can get that loose. We can jar that loose. This is a job you should have.
No, because you haven't heard the end of this sentence. When I get to be king, comma, I'm going to put you in charge of the coverage, because I like everything you've said. So you've been drafted back into service, sir.
And okay, and if I mess up, it'll be off with my head, because you'll be the king. So that's easy.
Works for me. Frank Sesno is the CNN Washington bureau chief, formerly anyway. And what are you doing when you're not doing this then?
I am now the director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University here in D.C., and so I am working with the next generation of storytellers and helping them put their brains around just exactly what we're talking about and what the new world of media that they're going to go in and be part of, and we hope lead, is going to look like, and how we're going to get there. I need to leave you and your listeners with a shred of optimism here, because I actually have it. And that is, you know, human beings are hunters and gatherers, and I think we're also hunters and gatherers of information. And in the end, we're going to know what information is going to help us hunt and gather well. And it's looking different, and it's going to continue to look different, and that's okay. We're never going to have Walter Cronkite again. Not going to happen. And so for you know, our students to come out and be the next you or the next me and manage that in what I refer to as three-dimensional journalism, all these different kinds of storytelling and technology platforms, that's what they're going to do. And they're doing some amazing things. So, you know, we'll see. It's going to be different. It's going to be uncomfortable for a while. I hope it's going to get us to a place where people can get the information they need to be informed.
Lucky the students at George Washington. Frank Sesno's there, and he'll be in Chicago on a stage with Jennifer Graham, two-term governor of Michigan, helped turn that state around after the crash, and Mike Huckabee, who is a Republican, she's a Democrat, one of the longest-serving governors in that state's history, a famous conservative and a famous father, Mike Huckabee, Jennifer Graham, and Frank Sesno on stage. You want details on that, go to spurtus.edu/conversation. The program is going to be on South Michigan Avenue, downtown Chicago, at 4:30 in the afternoon, and the date on that is not in front of my eyeballs. It is the 18th of March. There it is. Thank you, Elif. Sunday, March 18th at 4:30. Good luck to you. I hope we can meet in studio sometime. I sure appreciate your time, Frank.
I'd love that. Thanks so much, and good luck to you.
On my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John. Two things to notice there. One is more video of me dancing. It's a charity, and one of our sponsors, the Joint Relief Institute, said if you make a donation this week, they will double it. Please make a donation. Please watch the video. Please laugh at me. And we also put a really good brain teaser of a question that stumped members of the staff, and others saw it right away. How are you going to do? First, White Sox baseball, next on WGN.